Welcome to In-Depth, an in-depth look at the interesting, educational, and timely topics affecting you right here in Marion County and beyond. The one to count on for today's local news coverage is KNIA KRLS. And now with today's In-Depth, here is Dr. Bob Leonard.
How do we understand the rioting in Baltimore? Or can we? Let's go in-depth with Don Reese, professor of sociology at Central College. So, Don, how do anthropologists and sociologists and other social scientists try to make sense out of what's happening in Baltimore and what happened before in Ferguson and other cities, situations like that?
You know, this very complex behavior, and we're talking about social systems. So at that large level, it's a little harder to unpack, right? So we do spend a little bit of time talking about the different groups involved, the different organizations, the different institutions. That's one way to kind of break it down for students a little bit. Another thing I do is I always try to say, what is the behavior? What is the behavior that we're interested in? And sometimes just starting with the list of behaviors that we're interested in. And so why do young African-American men seem to be targeted for police violence? Why do people riot? So trying to break it down into these smaller questions where you're looking at behaviors, I think gets a little easier to then dissect and come up with some answers.
Well, sometimes, though, in the media, you'll see, they're just bad actors. They're just bad people. They're, you know, bad morals, and they're just doing bad things that they shouldn't do. And isn't it that simple? I mean, that's how it's presented to us sometimes.
Right, right. That's our culture. Our culture wants to always make something at the individual level because it's easier to then, you know, shrug your shoulders and say, well, it's just a few bad apples, right? Or it's bad apples, and then we don't have to fix the social structures. I would like to just talk about an example that I used in class that I think is really helpful. So why do people riot is a question we could ask. And so what I did in my class the other day is we talked about why do people riot. And what I did was I started with instances that I was very familiar with. So I was in Ames during some of the Vesha riots. So I said, these are the sorts of things that it took for students to riot. They felt a little stressed at school. Okay. Mm-hmm. There was some booze involved. People knew where to congregate, so there were open spaces. It's spring, right? So people know where campus town is. And then the last thing that it takes to get people to riot is being confronted by police telling you that you're doing something wrong. That's the only four ingredients they needed. So these are white, middle class, being educated kids, and those are the only things, the only ingredients needed to get those kids to riot. Right. They were throwing bottles. They were, people were being injured. They were starting things on fire. So there was vandalism. There was violence against the police. So if you take that situation here in Iowa, this happens in Iowa, right, during Vesha, then I don't think it's that hard to make a jump to another situation in which you have young kids. You probably have congregating spaces, right, spaces people knew would be available. And then perhaps drug and alcohol is involved. Perhaps it's not. But if you can have that happen in Ames under those circumstances, then of course you can have that happen when you also add ingredients like power differentials, stratification, knowledge of past events regarding the police, race. I mean, obviously all these things come into play. And if we can explain it in a white middle class situation, then we should use those same variables to try to explain it in a different context. So that's something that I thought the students really responded well to, is this idea that can we explain that outside of race and class, and then what happens when we add those variables in. Something else I noticed about those riots, and they were labeled riots, you know, in Vesha, was that when outsiders looked in, when the Des Moines Register talked about it or when the Ames Tribune talked about it, they didn't use a word like thugs. They didn't say, these are bad kids doing bad things. The language is much more like, these are just kids being kids, college kids being stressed out, and a few kids taking this a little too far. That's the kind of language you would hear talked about in the media. So it's interesting when you add the variable of race and class into the mix. Now, suddenly, we're using different sorts of words. And so I think our choice of words has everything to do with class and race.
The Visha example is a great example, but there really wasn't any reason for them to be angry, right? There's no, I mean, really, you can be angry about Freddie Gray and other kinds of things, the Garner I Can't Breathe fellow. There's a lot of things to not be happy about.
Exactly.
And Visha was, they didn't even have that.
Right, exactly, which is kind of, I'm hoping to get the students to recognize if it can happen when people aren't, you know what I mean? When there is no underlying social injustice going on. Of course it can happen when you add those variables or when you add long-term, right, social injustices. Absolutely, yeah.
More in depth after this. I continued my conversation about the rioting in Baltimore with Don Reese, professor of sociology at Central College.
I've lived in big cities before, and my observation is here, I know virtually every law enforcement officer. I know every law enforcement officer in Pella. I know all of them in Knoxville. I know all the deputies. And when they pull me over, they ask me to do something, I'm going to do that. And they know me. They know what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And in the larger cities, there's a more complex relationship with the population. I mean, and most everybody knows at least one police officer in our communities. It's a different thing when we don't know anyone.
Absolutely.
So there's that dynamic.
Right.
We don't know the officers. But then the officers in those communities, a lot of them have been through a lot. Right? There's a different kind of dynamic, both from the police officer's side and from the average citizen's side, right?
Yes, absolutely. So one thing that is very common in the social science literature is our findings about the relationship between police, especially in disadvantaged communities, and how oftentimes there are historical examples that will run through time of police not being the folks you go to for protect and serve. Rather, they're the, there are stories from both friends and family members about how police have not been there to protect and serve. And so in a lot of small communities, I think the idea is that those are your allies, right? And they're going to help maintain what is already an ordered community or an ordered space. But in some of these communities, you don't have police officers who actually reside in the area, and so that might complicate the matter. Again, we know in Ferguson that the police department was majority or dominant white, and the community is more African American. And so if those folks aren't living in the community, then I think there's more mistrust built up. And if those folks, again, aren't they're obviously not from the neighborhood because they're not African American or they're not from those smaller communities, then I do think that you're going to get less cooperative sorts of relationships.
I think I read the other day that the majority of the police officers in Baltimore, I think 60% of them are not from the city, and a lot of them are from out of state.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can't help.
Right. Again, so what is the likelihood that there is this kind of positive community-building approach to policing, and it's just less likely to occur in these neighborhoods?
Well, and what about the point being is that some of these neighborhoods are very rough, and that the police officers have a very difficult task. They're dealing with rough people every day in rough circumstances every day. And I would guess that they're less, if I were in that situation, I would be less tolerant of bad actors. It's sort of inevitable. So they're in a tough position in law enforcement on that side of it too, right?
Absolutely. Sure. So I find it really interesting if you watch some of the Facebook activity after, specifically after Ferguson, there were people who were coming on who were saying, you know, I support or Black Lives Matter. And then two posts later, you'd have somebody saying Police Lives Matter. And, you know, as a sociologist, I would agree with both. Right. And I want to figure out why is this such a polarizing issue? Why do we assume that if you believe Black Lives Matter, you don't believe that police life matter? I think most people would say both matter. Right. So then we have to figure out what's going on here at a structural level or at a cultural level that's causing, when something like this happens, to people to almost immediately kind of go into these camps. Because, in fact, I don't think that I think you're right. I think that we can understand the police behavior. Right. And over time, police are going to be socialized that they have to be on guard. And so that's easy to understand. But I think we maybe have a harder time understanding why is this happening? So why are Black lives being endangered?
More in depth after this.
I continued my conversation about the rioting in Baltimore with Don Reese, professor of sociology at Central College. Well, now then there's also the problems with inner cities. And I think I remember that Baltimore has, I don't know, I think the unemployment rate is close to 60%. And so I read something the other day is that unemployment rate is 60%. You can just pack up and leave. Why don't they choose to live there? Why don't they just get jobs? Why don't they go be valuable members of society? Why don't they?
Yeah, there's some really interesting research on that. Deborah Paver and some other sociologists have looked at unemployment. And first of all, we all know it costs a lot to move, right? So you have to have you have to be able to pay a down payment on a new living arrangement. You have to have transportation to move. And so, and most of us have a lot of stuff, right? So moving isn't as easy as just pick up and move. Oftentimes people also have social support networks that are extremely important to them. So you don't want people moving away from others who are providing them with economic assistance or providing them with childcare. So the whole just pick up and move, you know, obviously we know that's not as easy as it sounds. Back to the research by Pager, what she did was she had pairs of a Black guy and a white guy who were given basically similar resumes. Okay, so they have the same resumes, they're made up. You have a white guy and a Black guy. Both of these guys would go to entry-level jobs, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, dishwasher or, you know, someone who's going to park cars, valet, that sort of thing. And what she found was a very striking result that whites were getting more callbacks and were also getting channeled up. And when I say channeled up, I mean so they go in for the dishwasher job and the person who greets them or who takes their resume says, you know what, we've actually got a job being a host. Would that be something you'd like to do? So there's clear evidence that in these situations, African Americans just don't get the same amount of callbacks as whites do. So there's still job discrimination going on. In addition to that, she took her research first in Milwaukee, and then she repeated it in New York City. And so if we can find those sorts of differences by race, then I think we do have to realize it's just not that simple, that getting a job is going to be harder for someone who's African-American, specifically these lower-level entry jobs that might be available to folks that don't have a lot of education.
And to some of the people making the decisions, it might not even be a conscious decision at all.
Absolutely. There's research that kind of demonstrates that if you go and talk to these same employers, they're going to tell you that, of course, they're not going to discriminate. So, yeah, absolutely, there is some of that more, some people call it implicit racism or unconscious bias.
This is a big problem, and it's a growing problem. Any solutions on the horizon? Of course not. Are there? Has anybody offered any?
Yeah. So, you know, if we go with the individual sort of an approach, then, like I said, it becomes easier for us to just say, well, we've got to weed out the bad people in these neighborhoods, right? Take the bad people, incarcerate them, and then we're going to have more stable communities. But as a sociologist, I'm more interested in having macro level or broad level social change. So I think all these peaceful protests have been a step in the right direction. In Des Moines the other day, there were folks who were protesting. So protests that scan beyond just the confines of these communities that are distressed, I think, is a first step. I also think that there's been some talk about trying to create more opportunities. So it was interesting on the news the other night, they were saying, why are these kids out on the street? And a local pastor was saying, because they don't have after-school opportunities, because there aren't, entry-level jobs available to them, because they don't have transportation to get to those jobs. And so I do think that there are ways that we can approach this from a positive standpoint, which would be trying to connect people with those jobs more frequently, more often, providing incentives to businesses who will hire local, providing incentives to businesses who will go into these distressed areas, having more after-school programs, more sports opportunities for these kids, anything to keep them on a positive trajectory rather than a negative one.
Thanks to Don Reese for contributing to the program. For KNIA KRLS News, this is Dr. Bob Leonard bringing you today's news and information in depth from our little corner of the universe.
In Depth is available for podcast in the radio audio media player on KNIAKRLS.com. You'll find additional information, pictures, and more, or subscribe to the In Depth podcast and never miss an episode. If you have local topics you'd like to hear on In Depth, send an email to Bob Leonard at KNIAKRLS.com. The one to count on for today's news and local information is KNIAKRLS and KNIAKRLS.com.